Shine was 68 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I still vividly remember the moment when I opened up a package to see yet another book that had arrived at my home. I get books on a weekly basis from all kinds of different publishers and agents, hoping that I can interview the author on the morning show. I can't remember the last time I took hold of a book, saw its cover, and felt this sort of tightening sensation in my chest and this immediate sensation that I must talk to this author. Because on the cover of this book called Rethinking Rescue is a dog with these amazing eyes staring out. And it, as someone who owns and loves dogs, it got me thinking... even before reading the book, about the important story that would be a part of this journey. The book at hand is called Rethinking Rescue, Dog Lady and the Story of America's Forgotten People and Pets. It is by Carol Mithers, and in this book, Carol Mithers tells the extraordinary story of a woman named Lori Weiss, who has worked tirelessly over the last couple of decades to rescue dogs, but in a way quite distinct from the way most pet rescue operations occur. In fact, Lori Weiss is not even fond of the word rescue, but that's the term that often we use. But in this case, Lori Weiss is so anxious to reach out not only to dogs that are suffering in one way or another, but to their owners who are suffering as well. And that is a part of this equation that is so often neglected, even forgotten altogether. Not by Lori Weiss. And that is the heart of the story of this amazing book. The author with whom I'm speaking today, Carol Mithers, has written extensively about the city of Los Angeles, in which most of this story takes place, as well as various issues related to the great work of women. Perhaps you've seen her work in the New York Times, O Magazine, Los Angeles Magazine, Town and Country, The Nation, many, many other places. She has several previous books to her credit, including perhaps most famously Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. This book, which is published by Counterpoint, is again titled Rethinking Rescue, Dog Lady and the Story of America's Forgotten People and Pets. Carol Mithers, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. What a great introduction.
Well, I'm only sorry it went on as long as it did. That's probably a minute longer than I usually take with a book introduction, but there's a lot to cover. But it's really an amazing, important story. You met Lori Weiss in 2012, if I remember correctly. But her story extends well earlier than that. But tell us a little bit about how you first encountered Lori Weiss, and at that time, what you already knew about her and about her work.
At the time I met her, I knew nothing. I knew nothing about rescue, frankly. I had a, quote, rescue dog, or I guess I'd had two by that time, but I knew very little about the whole world. I stumbled on a story in the local newspaper, the LA Times, about an issue of animal hoarding, which was something I'd never heard of, and I was sort of horrified, fascinated by it, and talked to a friend I a very old friend that I'd recently reconnected with who ran a dog rescue and said, tell me about this phenomenon. And she said, you should go talk to Lori Weiss, because Lori had just finished dealing with a hoarder, and which was an experience I covered in the book. But I went and met with her. She was working downtown still, and she chatted with me, and I eventually wrote that story. But I also learned about the other work she was doing on the streets of downtown and then increasingly in South LA, which is one of our more economically challenged neighborhoods and historically ignored neighborhoods. And I thought, this is amazing. And I was going to write something. I thought, this is really selfless work she's doing. But the book did not really come together until I realized that there was a larger story. It wasn't just about one woman doing noble work. It was a whole look at inequality and how that manifested in the world of rescue, which was something, frankly, I had never even considered.
What was the means by which you were able to follow her story so closely? I mean, to what extent were you actually on hand and a witness in person to the kind of work that she was doing? I mean, was this, in a sense, investigative reporting of that nature, or did you otherwise learn about her work and come to this greater understanding of it in other ways?
It was a little of both. I mean, by the time I met her, she'd been working for over a decade. And so, unfortunately, I was not able to be with her when she was working downtown with unhoused people. And I deeply regretted that, because it would have been great. But I was able to spend time with her and then volunteered at some of the community clinics that she ran. These were sort of large-scale operations where a lot of volunteer vets would turn out and volunteer people, and community pets would be vaccinated and given microchips and various kinds of treatments, like flea treatments, not deep veterinary treatments. So I did that with her, and then I spent time with her second-in-command, Amanda Caceres, who was sitting at the shelter in South Los Angeles, talking to people about why they were coming in to surrender their pets and trying to see what, if anything, she could do to help them to where they could hold on to their animals. Then when Lori, later on, toward the very end of our work together, she took on a new operation where she was working with some really, in a really hardcore setting in Southeast LA with an encampment of people in trailers and RVs, and I was able to go with her there and so make up with what I hadn't been able to do downtown in the 90s. So I was on scene there.
You tell us a little bit about Lori's background, that is, some of what she experienced early in her life, and that's nothing that we need nor really have time to explore in any detail in this interview. But clearly, you regard it as important enough in her overall story that you included in your book. Could you just briefly summarize, in a sense, some of what Lori experienced early in her life that you think most clearly informed her reasons for devoting so much of her life and energy and money and resources to this work, rescuing animals? What lines can we trace from her earlier life?
She had two major traumas, and one was as a child of a parent with mental illness that was undiagnosed for many years, and a chaotic childhood as a result. And that was, two things came out of that. One was that her dog was her source of solace and stability. And the second was that I think it gave her a great understanding of how to be compassionate and speak to people with mental illness and various kinds of other problems who were often who she met, especially when she was working downtown. She was able to enter their reality in a way that was that made communicating with them possible. The second was that she, it was an episode of sexual exploitation. And again, I think that made her less trusting of people and more inclined to find a family with animals. I mean, these kinds of experiences make it very hard, I think, to have a normal, happy life. Maybe normal is not a good word, but an average happy life. And she was really driven to find a purpose for herself. It wasn't, not everybody feels this way. Some people are content to just have a pleasant life, go to work, come home, have a beer, watch TV. She really felt the need to serve and have a purpose. And she was deeply unhappy until she found this purpose.
Right. And it changed everything. I mean, it changed so much in her life, and it changed a great deal in many other lives, both the lives of other humans and the lives of animals. We're speaking with Carol Mithers about her book, Rethinking Rescue, Dog Lady and the Story of America's Forgotten People and Pets. It follows the efforts over many, many years of a woman by the name of Lori Weiss, who continues to engage in what we think of as animal rescue. And we'll talk in a few minutes about why she really dislikes that particular term. You tell us early in the book that, in your words, Lori's journey began at a pivotal moment for domestic animals. Two overlapping and complementary movements were striving to upend more than 100 years of accepted policy and vastly improve conditions for pets. Explain these two things which occurred pretty much simultaneously that changed the landscape so much.
We had the growth of what has come to be called the no-kill movement, which was essentially looking at what had been an acceptable practice for a long time, that when pets were not wanted, pets were considered surplus, dogs and cats were found on the street, that they would be sent to a shelter and basically done away with almost immediately. It started as a way to protect cities in 100 years ago from stray packs of fierce and rabid animals. But we had really been treating pets as disposable for a long time. Before spay and neuter became popular in the late 70s, even so-called good middle-class people, their pets would get out, they would impregnate each other, and unwanted litters would be born, and they'd be sent to the shelter and put down. And this new movement was saying, this is unacceptable. We have to stop. Now, what do you do with all those animals that are in the shelter? Because not everybody understood that there were fabulous dogs and cats to be found there. They were, I think, widely considered second rate. People went to breeders instead. And so rescue groups grew to become like middlemen and women, since they were mostly women, to take those pets out of the shelter, spiff them up a bit, and then advertise them and try to promote their rescue. And those two movements were very dependent on each other, because you couldn't say stop killing all the animals in the shelter if you didn't have somewhere to place them. So this was a way to funnel shelter pets into new homes.
You tell us that because of this, the number of animals who died, that number plummeted quite dramatically. What you go on to explain, however, is that this set in motion a narrative that maybe at a careless glance wouldn't seem to be a problem, but the more you would think about it, the more disconcerting it would be. A narrative that, in your words, was stirring, but also deeply judgmental. Explain the nature of this very common narrative that was embraced in this.
Well, the narrative in brief is, here is a dog or cat in the shelter. This baby is suffering. It's here because someone dumped it. What a piece of F this this previous owner was. And I think that that narrative was very useful at the beginning of this movement because sympathy had to be stirred, and this was a very good way to do it. But what it didn't look at is, why were those animals in the shoe? Why had somebody let those animals go? Why had somebody not spayed or neutered their pet, and so a litter was there? Why there were, by some estimates, about 30% of animals that are in the shelter are there because their owners deliberately turned them in. But why? We didn't ask, what had that animal's story been before it ended up unwanted? And was it always the fact that a human being was a jerk? It is easier to believe that so because it gives us someone to hate, because there is in fact a lot of misery involved here. But maybe that easy answer isn't really the whole story.
Mm. I think in particular I'm haunted by this sentence in this chapter when you write, animals in shelters don't necessarily belong to humans who did not love them, but to those who lacked resources, chiefly money. In other words, it is easy to jump to the conclusion, and in some respects, it probably makes us feel even more noble if we adopt a pet from a shelter and we feel like we are taking that animal callously mistreated in its previous life and giving it a much better life. And that sets us up in a framework that probably feels very, very good, but what you are suggesting is that narrative is incomplete or carelessly drawn, and a human element is being missed.
Right, it may be true, but it may not be true. Look, there are terrible people out there who do terrible things to animals and who neglect them and who beat them and who are cruel to them. Nobody denies that. But there are also people whose animals get out because they live in a rented house or apartment where they don't have adequate fencing. There are people whose animals get mange and they don't have access to a vet to help treat them. There are people who don't have access or know about a subsidized spay and neuter, and so their animals give birth when they didn't mean to because they live in a community that's crowded and there are a lot of animals. And so you have to make a distinction between people who are bad to pets and people who simply don't have the ability to care for them properly. Maybe that's money. Maybe that's also education. Maybe it's access. You know, if you have a large 60, 70-pound dog and you don't have a car, how are you supposed to get it to a vet?
Hmm. You write at one point, the conventional rescue story, which begins with a pet abandoned to suffer in the shelter and ends happily in a new home while lauding the heroism of its rescuer, renders these humans invisible. Or worse, it condemns them to become those people. Irresponsible and uncaring, owners who don't deserve a pet and whose animals are better off elsewhere anyway. Towards the end of this chapter, you kind of talk about how that's a simple story. It's a sad story and it's a simple story, and that's why we're drawn to it. And that the true story or the full story about needy dogs and cats is part of a larger one about inequality, race, class, and gender. So that is the difficulty here, is are we willing, do we dare examine this, experience this in its full complication?
It's really hard because it means that there is no easy answer. You know, if you look at the whole no-kill rescue movement and the slogans, you know, save them all, adopt, don't shop, it suggests that if a few good people step forward, or many good people step forward, the problem will simply be resolved. I wish it was that simple. You know, we've had now, these movements really got off the ground in the late 90s. They have grown and grown and grown ever since. And right now, across the United States, the shelters are full, and there are more animals than ever. And it has to do with economic and other events in the lives of humans. And I talked at one point about you can't empty a shelter or place all these animals as long as more keep coming in, because it's like trying to empty a bathtub with the tap turned on. And what turns on the tap? It is not a simple issue of, oh, here's some really bad people who don't want to be pet parents. Some people, in 2008, there was, we remember the Great Recession, and there were a ton of people who lost their homes, and you know what? Their pets also lost their homes and ended up in the shelter. And so the economic fate of humans almost inevitably affects the fate of pets.
Right. And in your book, you share a really vivid portrait of people coming to shelters with their pets and having to surrender them, tears streaming down their faces. I mean, heartbroken at having to give up a beloved pet because they know, having suffered a severe economic reversal, they cannot provide for this pet that means so much to them. And
they can't find a home that will accept them. They can't find an apartment or a home that they can afford that will allow them to bring that pet. And there are a lot of, when I talked about judgmentalists, there are a lot of well-meaning rescue-type folks who say things like, I would rather sleep in the street than give up my dog or cat. And my response is that you probably never faced that. It's very different when that is actually a real choice and you've got kids.
That reminds me of an interesting point that you make, which is that for probably a number of different reasons, that when we look at people who work in the rescue movement, that this movement is disproportionately composed of mostly affluent and almost entirely white women. And right. And of course, many of them might be entirely well-meaning. But you point out that there is a problem there, or certainly at least a potential problem, when so many of the people who are part of this movement come from a certain part of society and view the world in a certain way.
I think it's simply that it's easy if you grow up and live in comfort to not understand the level of problems that other people face. It's just a lot of well-meaning good social movements have been led by affluent white women. So there's nothing wrong with that, because rescue doesn't pay, and it's really hard work. And nobody who works two jobs or is short of money is going to have the time and ability to do that kind of work. So if you have privilege to do good with it, yay. But if you don't open your eyes to get why somebody is living a very different kind of life and the very real pressure that something like poverty imposes on you, I'm not even sure if you know about it intellectually, you could understand it. Because, you know, people who don't have the money to go to the doctor, people who live with aching teeth because they don't have money for the dentist, people who are constantly worried about scraping together the money to pay the rent. I understand these things intellectually, but I don't. It's very difficult to feel it, in your heart, what it's like to live under those circumstances.
By the way, this is probably as good a time as any, and I think we've danced around this, but let's just give you the opportunity to say once and for all why Lori Weiss so dislikes the term rescue, or the misunderstanding about all this that that can be a part of using that term, rescue.
For some of the reasons we've just talked about, I think she thinks that it implies a kind of saviorism that is good for the person who is taking that for themselves, but it's misleading. She one of the terms she talked to me about was like, you know, I don't save dogs. I like to say I recycle them. So it has less judgment attached to it.
We're speaking with Carol Mithers, and we're talking about her book, Rethinking Rescue, Dog Lady and the Story of America's Forgotten People and Pets. It is primarily the story of Lori Weiss and some of the really truly groundbreaking and remarkable work that she has done for many, many years, seeking to help those in poverty who have pets, and trying to help pets and owners alike into a better life. Carol Mithers, tell us about Downtown Dog Rescue, which is based in Los Angeles and was among the first so-called dog rescue agencies that really sought to do their work in a different, new way.
Downtown Dog Rescue still exists. It's online and Instagram and easily findable. It's kind of changed over the years. When Lori was still working downtown, it really was for downtown dogs. And she, at the furniture factory she managed, there was a kennel on site. And now the kennel is based just south of downtown in Southgate. And Lori works less in and out of the shelter. She is trying to get started with her own mobile veterinary clinic. She's raised money and outfitted a clinic, a van, and hired a vet. And she has plans to take that van through neighborhoods that need assistance and do things like treatments and spay and neuter. So it's morphed and evolved some over the years. While they're still dogs that they take in and that they find new homes for, but it's much more community oriented than it was in the early days. Hmm.
Tell us something remarkable that you saw with your own eyes in terms of the work that Lori and others were doing with the Downtown Dog Rescue.
Well, I was just amazed. But I went downtown with them one time. They were doing a community clinic on Skid Row, which is a pretty harsh and dreadful neighborhood downtown, where a lot of really marginal people live on the street. And both Lori and a group of volunteers who have been with her for years and show up at all these events came, and there were vets. There was somebody doing their spay and neuter surgery on the spot. They had people from LA's public health organizations and homeless services. So they were trying to bring together not only services for animals, but there are ways to bring people into the system as well. And then for a while, she also had a housing rights attorney who would show up at her events and was trying to bring all kinds of services to people who maybe wouldn't seek them otherwise. And it was like a stealth organizing that, you know, you have people who really cared for their pets, but maybe would never seek help for themselves. And yet there it was. And some of the people there were really, really, they were really out there. And yet they trusted her, and they turned over their animals in some cases with tears. There was one woman in a wheelchair who was just weeping because she had turned over her dog to be spayed, and she was very scared that something might happen to it. It was fine, but you had someone like Lori come over to her and just say, like, I'm really proud of you. You did the right thing. Everything's going to be fine. And the end, she was, it was bringing understanding and compassion to this very difficult group of people.
There are a whole lot of amazing stories that you tell as we follow her in her work in Los Angeles, South Los Angeles, Compton. One of the most amazing stories, and you're probably asked about it a lot in these interviews, is a story about a particular dog named Bertha. And and it is an encounter that really underscores how someone like Lori is risking serious injury and sometimes is called upon to do amazing things, not only to protect herself, but other people, other dogs, and so on. Do you would you mind just telling at least some of the story of Bertha?
Bertha the bad dog. You know, somebody at a reading I gave the other night said that they were quite horrified by all of the dog-on-dog violence in the book, which, yeah, most of us in suburbia really don't see. But Bertha was a dog that was turned in when the kennel was still downtown, and she hated everybody. And when for a long time downtown, the kennels were pretty rudimentary because they just didn't have money to build them well. And one morning, Bertha got out. She was, I believe, a pit bull, and she headed out to go after another dog that was also a wildish dog. It was a guard dog for one of the other businesses near the factory. And Lori was terrified because some of the factory workers tried to break up this dog fight, and she was afraid that someone would get badly hurt and she would lose her job. And so she ran in there and took a Home Depot bucket, one of those 5-gallon buckets, and just jammed it on the dog's head. And somebody started screaming, "You'll kill her!" And she was like, "I don't care. This is over." And she got the dog.
She's going down.
She's going down. She got the dog back into her kennel. And as I said in the book, that for years, whenever she and her coworker had a bad day, they would say, "Yeah, well, it's not as bad as the Bertha bucket fight." So.
There were
many fights. There were many dog fights because a lot of these dogs were street dogs and they were wild. And also, you know what? If we are not with them on leashes, they fight. I mean, suburban dogs fight too. They just don't have the opportunity very often.
Right. And I remember, I think ahead of telling the story of Bertha, there was the effort to try to set up some sort of safe exercise system, because here you have all of these dogs, many of which really needed proper exercise in order to just kind of burn off some of that excess energy, which one would hope they're not going to then use against one another. But even a matter such as that can really pose difficult issues. And it's also fascinating to follow some of her interactions with some of the people in these neighborhoods with whom she would work, and the really delicate dance that she would have to sort of do in order to not generate really angry responses. I mean, to build trust, to not push too hard or too aggressively, particularly in these instances where you see a innocent little puppy that is suffering and you desperately want to have it in order to provide it proper care, but it belongs to someone else. And there's this whole psychological aspect of this kind of work that I think most of us from the outside looking in would never stop to even think about.
Right. I mean, one of the saddest stories I think she told me was when a street person downtown trusted her to take a little pup, cute little puppy, and get it spayed. And she did it. And then a couple of days later, he told her it had gotten into the street and been hit by a car. And she was devastated and thought, you know, if I had kept this dog, it would still be alive. And yet, had she kept it, that man would no longer have trusted her and would have spread the word to other people on the street that she had taken his dog, and it would have ended what she was trying to do. So it's really hard. And somebody I talked to recently was talking about how difficult it is in rescue to see past the one and look at the greater good. And so, you know, you find an animal that seems really needy or adoptable or cute, and you really want to help it, and yet maybe what you're trying to do will destroy or set back a larger effort. And it's really hard to see big picture when you're involved with sentient beings that you want to help.
Exactly. And looking into the eyes of a beautiful animal and wanting desperately to help this animal right now. I wonder if you could say a quick word about the lessons learned from one of the most horrific disasters to be suffered in our country, namely Hurricane Katrina, back in 2005. And I'm sure many of our listeners are well aware of one aspect of that enormous tragedy was the terrible fate that befell so many pets who had to be left behind. And it is heartbreaking to think about. Beyond that, beyond just the heartache of that, what is it that we need to learn from this part of the Katrina disaster?
The Katrina disaster resulted in one good thing, which is that the bill that passed in 2006 or seven, I think, that now not allows and requires that emergency evacuations include pets, so that when Hurricane Harvey hit, people were able to get shelter with their pets, which they weren't with Katrina. But I think it just showed us how much we care more about animals than people, and I don't think we quite resolved that. When other natural disasters have occurred, you see millionaires and billionaires, in some cases, who are animal lovers, swooping in and arranging for emergency transport for pets in shelters, but there's no such assistance for the people. Hmm. You know, we still have this image of the animals are innocent and blameless, and we still, to an unfortunate degree, see people in poverty as having caused their own situations, and so it's not really our responsibility to help them in the same way.
Hmm. We're speaking with Carol Mithers. We're talking about her book, Rethinking Rescue, Dog Lady and the Story of America's Forgotten People and Pets. I must confess that beyond the compelling story of Lori Weiss and her work, which is the heart and soul of your book, that it was really interesting to read in the third part of your book, titled Heroes and Villains, about some of the darker sides of what we call the rescue movement, including a fair amount of sort of in-house squabbling, and the fact that there are crooks and con artists that are often engaged in this kind of work, or seemingly in this kind of work. You actually met someone who had created a group called Hope for Paws that had something of a bad reputation, at least in some circles. And when you were able to connect with him and arrange to meet with him, you were expecting to meet yet another one of these sort of hucksters. And it didn't really play out quite that way. Just tell us briefly about this encounter.
Well, Hope for Paws is not exactly a rescue. It is a couple of people led by one guy who do what they call extreme rescue, and they find situations or are told of situations where an animal is in really sort of dramatic jeopardy, like a cat has fallen down a hole and is going to die because nobody can get it out. And they actually do save those animals, and the whole thing is videoed and then posted on YouTube, and billions of people watch it. And then they ask for a donation to continue the work. It's not that there's anything terrible about what he's doing, but it is, I think, very deceptive because it's really a small number of rescues that bring in a lot of money and really, in my mind, have nothing to do with the larger effort of trying to keep animals out of the shelter and help people. It's like a kind of voyeurism. I called it redemption porn, because you watch these videos of these heroic rescues, and it's really kind of addicting because the animal's in jeopardy, the hero comes in, the animal is saved and cleaned up, and it all ends happily. But it doesn't take you anywhere. You know, it doesn't lead you to solve a larger problem.
Absolutely. In the very next chapter, you talk about something that a lot of us have heard at least a bit about, and that is the title of the chapter, Chapter 9, is When a Rescuer is a Hoarder. And that is, of course, that situation when a line is crossed in really terrible ways, and we'll have somebody who has a house that is actually just brimming from basement to attic with all kinds of animals, far more than they can properly take care of, and often those situations end very, very tragically. And you tell us that there are several types of these kind of animal hoarders. Some are sociopaths, you tell us. Some are well-meaning, overwhelmed caregivers where it just kind of gets away from them. And then there is something called the rescue hoarder. In your words, someone whose benevolent mission has become a destructive compulsion. Tell us more about the way this typically plays out.
It's someone who has come to believe that no one can care for the animals the way she does. I use she, again, it tends to be mostly women, very educated women. And the animals are brought in and kept, and somehow the rescuer cannot see the misery that they are living in. I actually, not for this book, but for a story I wrote back in 2015, I met someone who had been accused of being a rescue hoarder by many people, had gotten in a lot of trouble for it. And she actually, to this day, denied that was possible. She said, I'm articulate. I was brought up in a nice home. But she had a lot of dogs. They were kept in cages. They were never let out. They were dirty. She was busted multiple times. The expert I talked to about it, Gary Petronic, who headed a group that was doing research on this phenomenon at Tufts for a number of years, we don't actually know still why this happened. There's current theories are that some kind of childhood trauma and unstable parenting. The animals are a source of comfort. They never will leave. They are. I feel a sense of belonging and mission taking care of them. And somehow those people don't see how bad things are. The hoarding houses that get busted, sometimes the rescue personnel will have to go in wearing gas masks because the smell is so horrifying. And yet they don't see it. It's really mystifying. And no one has yet figured out how to make it stop.
Right. And of course, just about all kinds of hoarding are similarly mystifying. I mean, even if it's all your thing is mountains and mountains of newspapers and magazines, or mountains and mountains of clothing you will never wear, or in the cases you talk about in your book, a house that is filled with dogs that are not properly cared for at all. This is what you write at one point, which I think is so interesting. And it's partly in answer to that question of how does a self-proclaimed savior of animals become the prime agent of their misery? And later you write that people with something broken inside use animals to attempt self-repair. Makes a cruel kind of sense. Hoarding's an ugly mirror image of what even the best pet owners find appealing in their dogs and cats. They're ours. They won't disappoint us the way human loved ones can. They're endlessly devoted, forever dependent. No matter what we do, they will never leave. It's so interesting to think about the relationship that we have with our pets, and how that relationship can sometimes go awry. In the last couple of minutes, though, let's give you an opportunity to talk about kind of the sum total of what you observed, and just a couple of your thoughts on the ways in which this thing we call animal rescue can be done better. And are there encouraging signs that we are moving in that direction?
I think there are very encouraging signs in that in the last 4 or 5 years, particularly as America started talking more about inequality, efforts to change the judgmental thinking have sprouted up in a lot of places, and efforts to help people who need help caring for their pets have also grown. I think that for me, the biggest lesson in all this was twofold. It was one, that nothing that we do in this day and age, and nothing that we attempt, comes without some connection to the larger issues of inequality and poverty and race and gender. And it's like there's nothing that comes clean. It's all got roots in those places. But the second is that we all, or most of us anyway, really love our pets. And that kind of love is a way to bridge the differences that are very much there right now. You know, if you can go to a Skid Row and see someone crying about their dog, you can recognize a kindred spirit. You know, maybe we have nothing else in common, but we have that. And so even Lori said at one point, you know, pets unite us. Our love for pets unites us. And if we can remember that, I think we have more compassion for people who are not like us and for people who need a little bit of help.
Right. Very, very well put. And yes, that's actually one of my favorite quotes in the whole book. I have it earmarked at page 121. Dogs connect us, Lori told me.
Yeah.
They enable us to have a conversation. And she goes on to say, often conversations with people with whom we would otherwise maybe not feel like exchanging a single word. Well, I came away from your book thinking about so many things in new and intriguing ways, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to have read Rethinking Rescue, Dog Lady and the Story of America's Forgotten People and Pets, published by Counterpoint, the author Carol Mithers. Carol Mithers, thank you so much for writing this really important book. And thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you for giving me the chance to talk about it.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Thomas Carr, director of the paleontology program at Carthage College, talking about their most recent field expedition to rural Montana. And on Wednesday, Doug Instant is from the Racine Theater Guild, talking about their current production, Murder on the Orient Express. Today's going to be a very warm day under sunny skies, a high close to 89 degrees. Overnight low of 58. Tomorrow, a little more comfortable with a high of 83. a high closer to 80 degrees on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And right now, nothing in the way of rain in our forecast for the next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. WP.